This is Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, with face coverings having become so common during COVID-19, a researcher will tell us which material is best at preventing the spread. Also, an Illinois company is working on ways to extend the use of the popular N95 masks. A comedy institution is for sale. Second City Comedy Theater in Chicago opened in 1959 and has launched numerous careers.
All of a sudden, people started becoming famous out of Second City.
We'll hear about the struggles of movie theaters during the pandemic. You might notice more newspapers are steering away from political endorsements this election season. It's a trend in the industry, and we'll discuss some of the reasons. Also, we'll learn about an insect that has become more prevalent in Illinois, and probably trying to get in your house this time of year. That and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, there was a time when going to the movie theater was an escape, but the pandemic has changed. But the pandemic has changed everything, and theaters are struggling. A comedy institution based in Chicago, Second City, is up for sale. And an artist finds opportunity after a devastating storm. We'll have those stories and more ahead. We are in the midst of election season, and for as long as anyone can remember, newspapers made political endorsements. But for some, that tradition is coming to an end. Lisa Richardson is the executive editor of the State Journal Register in Springfield, and her paper has made this decision to stop making endorsements. Lisa, thanks for joining me, and I guess a basic question would be, why?
Well, I'm glad to be with you today, Sean. First of all, I have to say that it was not an easy decision to make. Because as you say, a lot of newspapers have traditionally endorsed candidates. But, you know, as we thought about the climate that we're in, we thought that our best course of action would be to do what we do best, which is report stories, present information for people, and to present enough information so people can make their own decisions. We are talking with candidates every day. We are publishing question and answers. We will have a voter's guide that will come out in the next week or so that will help people look at the candidates based on their own ballots. Again, they can make their own decisions. I think that it also protects our independence as looking at both sides of every issue.
I know as a reporter, it's always made me a bit uneasy when a paper endorses, because that decision is often not made by the reporter in the field or the person who's out covering a certain race. You have to be objective if you're a reporter, and you have to talk with all sides. But I find that reporters often are put on the defense because of endorsements made by the paper. So that plays into this a little bit, too.
Well, obviously, reporters aren't a part of that conversation. You know, we keep that separate. And I think that that's one of the misnomers that people have out in, outside our newsrooms, is that they think that reporters have some say in endorsements, and they really don't. But so that wasn't exactly why we made that decision. But you're right. People think that.
Well, you pointed out in a column that you wrote on this subject that the Pew Research Center found local newspaper endorsements showed only about 14% of voters were positively influenced by them and 14% negatively influenced. So what does that tell you as far as the need to do endorsements or the importance of them?
In that research, it showed that people were pretty evenly split, but it's only 14% either way. So, I would think that, for those who still do endorsements, maybe you can make a case for it. And for those of us who decided not to, we found a case for not doing them.
I have to ask, because a cynic might say, a lot of newspapers are owned by corporations. They rely on both subscriptions and also on advertising dollars. And that sometimes making an endorsement can anger somebody. It can be, can lead to money loss. But was that part of this decision, at least from your paper's perspective?
Not at all. None of our decisions that we make, journalistic decisions, are based on advertising or the money that may be made or lost.
I've heard some experts also say that, well, endorsements by a newspaper may not matter a lot in a high-profile race like a governor's race or maybe a presidential race where a lot of people are following, you know, what's going on, following the issues and the information that's available. But they can be valuable on those, what we refer to as down-ballot races, the ones people may not know much about, judgeships, those types of things.
Maybe they do, but I think that, again, our purpose and our better way of providing the information is just writing the stories that informs the reader about the issues and the stances of a particular candidate in a particular race. I think that that's our best use of our resources. That's our best way to serve the reader.
We're in a different time when it comes to the media landscape, how people view the media. There's a lot of skepticism out there. Does that have an impact, too, on a decision to drop endorsements because people already are skeptical of where the what the media is trying to say?
Possibly, but it didn't have any influence in our decision at all. I think that we've been experiencing that for a few years now. And it's because of all the various ways that people get information now and the various outlets that call themselves media when they might not be credible media. So I think that that goes into it as well. And then you can't dismiss the fact that there are a lot of people out there who find it beneficial to say that, you know, what we report, even though it's credible, is not. So I think it's coming from all corners, but that did not weigh in any way on our decision not to endorse. We work every single day to make sure that we are reporting the stories that are important to this community, taking a hard look at issues, and then, you know, presenting the stories that reflect the community, be it in election season or not. And I just hope that people understand that and continue to support local journalism because it's important to the community.
Lisa Richardson is the executive editor of the State Journal Register in Springfield, and we've been talking about her paper and many others ending political endorsements. Lisa, thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Sean.
The iconic sketch comedy and improv school, The Second City, is up for sale. The owners say it's time for a new generation with fresh ideas to take the company to the next level. Whether new owners can return Second City to its one-time place as a premier breeding ground for talent remains to be seen. Carrie Shepherd has that story.
Mentioning the Second City invokes the names of some of the biggest players in recent comedy history. Carell, Colbert, Poehler, Faye.
I was on my way to work this morning and I saw something very weird. Do you know what it was? I'm not Dionne Warwick. I saw you parked in a car making out with a boy.
Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
That's Tina Fey and Rachel Dratch on the Second City stage in the late 90s. But Jeffrey Sweet's memories go farther back.
Mike Nichols, Barbara Harris, Alan Arkin, Alan Alda, Robert...
Sweet Klein, is author
David
of the
Steinberg,
1978 book Something Rivers, Wonderful Right Away, an oral history of the Second City and the Compass Players.
The last person I interviewed for the book was Gilda Radner.
Sweet says he's not surprised that Second City is for sale now. Longtime owner and former CEO Andrew Alexander said earlier this summer he was ready to move on. That was after the pandemic shut down stages and current and former performers accused leadership of fostering a racist and sexist culture. Second City would not make anyone available to talk. They repeatedly pointed to a statement that says, quote, "The company will consider qualified expressions of interest through a process that will play out over the coming months." This isn't the first time in its 60-year history that the place has had to wrestle with what it is and where it's going. Second City started as a satirical takedown of the system and the man, political humor with a punch of intellect. Here's author Jeffrey Sweet.
Then all of a sudden, people started becoming famous out of Second City, and people went to Second City to start their careers.
Even before the Colberts and Fays, Second City was a pipeline to Saturday Night Live, led by John Belushi, Bill Murray, and Gilda Radner. Sweet says it became the place you go to get laughs, get noticed, get famous.
After Saturday Night Live came along, very few people came in and said, I'm filled with burning political ideas. I want to, you know, satirize and articulate my outrage at the injustice of society.
I think when anything starts out as, you know, stick it to the man, and then all of a sudden it becomes an institution, naturally you're going to have growing pains. The good news is the business is growing, and the bad news is it's painful.
Susan Messing is a longtime Chicago improviser who was on Second City's main stage from 1998 to 2000. Messing is referring to Second City's move to add corporate trainings and shows on cruise lines to the lineup of comedy classes and performances. She says fast growth, multiple businesses to keep operations going, is a hard balance at a place born out of the counterculture. But Messing isn't longing for the old days.
I'm not such a purist where I'm saying this thing works, because a lot of the rules they had in place 40 years ago are what people are saying burn it all to the ground now about.
Messing is talking about the wave of criticism from Second City alums that the culture there is racist, sexist, homophobic, and transphobic. Second City responded to those comments the way many companies do, creating diversity committees and issuing mea culpas. Andrew Alexander, the co-owner who stepped down as CEO, said at the time he, quote, failed to create an anti-racist environment where an artist of color might thrive. Improviser Messing says she hopes the Second City will thrive again by returning to its roots.
And if you do follow the precepts of improv, you know, sometimes you know what the thesis is and sometimes you don't. And you just do things and you make discoveries along the way.
Messing says she hopes whoever buys the Second City will keep it here, because Chicagoans would miss it. You always know it's there, even if you haven't been there in a while. Carrie Shepard, WBEZ News.
The pandemic has drastically changed how we watch movies, and that's having a big impact not only on movie studios, but on local theaters. Tim Shelley spoke with Corey Barker. He's a Bradley University professor who's researching how COVID-19 is impacting film distribution.
Early in the pandemic, there were a number of films that were slated to be released in early March, right when the pandemic really hit badly in the United States, and how studios decided to push a lot of those planned theatrical releases to what they're calling, you know, premium video on demand, which is essentially dropping it on iTunes or the Amazon store or Google Play. And instead of allowing you to rent it for $3 or $6, they were charging $20, because the idea was that this is supposed to be a movie that's in theaters and therefore pay a premium. And obviously that's an attempt to try to make some money back that they're losing from it not being in the theater.
How successful have theaters been in trying to push new releases and more people to these platforms?
To be honest, I don't feel like it's been as successful as they had hoped. In the beginning of our pandemic world in the United States, there was a lot more of this experimentation to try to make some of that money up. And then as we got into May and June, when we're reaching basically the normal kind of summer blockbuster calendar, there was obviously a real resistance from the major studios to release films that wouldn't, you know, theoretically make $1 billion or more than $1 billion worldwide in the theater. And so you started to see more kind of panic and consideration for what to do. You know, the big kind of talking point was surrounding Disney's Mulan. And Disney took another approach with Mulan and decided to release it to Disney Plus. And they said, if you want to pay $30, so even more of a premium, this is an opportunity to see a movie that we were planning on releasing in theaters. But then Disney announced that it was pushing all of its planned, you know, movies that it was going to release this fall and this winter that were originally planned to be released in the spring and summer to next year, or even, you know, at the end of next year. And there wasn't really a suggestion that many of those films would go to Disney Plus. So that tells me that as we move through this pandemic and people's experiences have kind of dragged on at being mostly in their house and stuck with certain types of entertainment and not being able to access others, the experimentation that was happening earlier in the pandemic has kind of gone by the wayside as the studios realize that their primary way of making money is really the best way for them forward, even if that means taking 6 months to a year before they release those movies.
What does this mean for the traditional movie theater then? Because they were closed for several months as we were dealing with the pandemic. They've now reopened in a limited form with, reduced seating capacity and other measures in place. But for the large part, theaters still are kind of operating right now for the most part. So what's this mean for the future of it? The way you describe it, it sounds like the major studios are kind of banking on the traditional movie theater model making a comeback post-COVID, but they're willing to kind of wait it out, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting tension point, right, is that the studios certainly have a lot of money invested in the films that they've already produced in their sort of production pipeline, but they have more resources to essentially wait out the pandemic or try to wait it out a little bit more. Theater chains not necessarily having the resources to be able to wait these things out, right? As far as financially, there's a lot of, AMC's executive board and leadership team has repeatedly talked about, what needs to happen as far as their ability to stay afloat. And, that's partially why they've reopened under limited terms, because they thought that if they open, then the studios will have no choice but to put these movies out in theaters, because the studio's bottom line, is dictated by the success of these type of big blockbuster films. When these movie theaters opened up and they didn't necessarily get the new releases, that's kind of a self-generating cycle where they don't have a lot of new releases. People are still skeptical, so they don't go to the theater. And then the studios say, well, people aren't going to the theater. They're not risking it. So no, we're not going to release another new film, right? And so that just keeps moving forward. I think the theaters are hoping that they will have the ability to hold out, at least until spring of 2021. They are so beholden to how people feel about the virus and their own safety in those public spaces.
Corey Barker, a Bradley University professor, speaking with Tim Shelley. Stay with us. There's more to come on Statewide. We'll learn more about something we've become quite familiar with this year, masks. That's on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Just ahead, how school bus drivers are handling their jobs during the pandemic. And we'll talk a bit about the graduated income tax proposal that's on the ballot this fall. That and more still ahead. For months, the CDC has recommended people wear masks in public settings to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. That federal guidance is based on research on the effectiveness of different materials at blocking the tiny droplets we all produce when we cough, sneeze, and talk. One of those studies comes from the University of Illinois' Urbana campus, and it was just published in a peer-reviewed journal. Christine Herman spoke with the lead author, mechanical engineer Tahir Saif, about the research.
So you set out to study 11 different fabric materials, and a lot of them are like common household fabrics, t-shirt material, different cotton, polyester blends, as well as like dishcloth. Can you just describe what the setup was like, how you went about comparing these different fabric materials to surgical masks?
So, our goal was to reproduce the cough. Let me give you some very broad overview. You have a tube. And the tube has the cloth covering. And imagine that one side of the cloth covering has high pressure and lots of nanoparticles, dry nanoparticles. So because of the high pressure, the air flows through the cloth. And then there is a particle counter on both sides. And you count the number of particles per unit volume of air. And then you say, what was the efficiency of the cloth? But we realized that it is not those particles in dry environment, it's gonna be large droplets. So now how do we get large droplets that would mimic somebody who is sneezing, coughing, and talking? And we cannot have a human patient, that is not allowed. So we found out that if you take an inhaler, and if we fill up the nozzle of the inhaler with a small droplet of water and nanoparticles, those nanoparticles glow, so you can see them one by one. Their size is 100 nanometers, which is similar to the virus particles. Now, when you puff it, then what happens is the pressure inside the inhaler creates an array of droplets, and you can see them they are released with high velocity, and the velocity is about 17 meters per second, which is right in the middle of what we know, what happens during cough, talk, and sneezing. It's about 10 meters per second to about 40 meters per second. And the droplet size that people release are also anywhere between, you know, few microns in size to about a millimeter in size. So we capture both the speed of the droplets, the size of the droplets, and now our droplets are carrying 100 nanometer fluorescent particles, which glow. So it's a perfect setup. All we do is now we put a cloth in front and we hit the droplets on the t-shirt and see how many particles go through. And we collect them in a petri dish on the other side.
And then since they're fluorescent, you can then analyze the petri dish for how many particles came through.
Exactly. And then do the same experiment without the cloth. And then we can compare with one layer cloth, with two layer cloth, with three layer cloth, and see what is the efficiency.
So what advice or what significance, I guess, does this research have for the everyday person who's trying to figure out what kind of cloth mask should I wear? Based on material, but also I'm curious about fit.
Very, very good point. So for any mask, what you want is that the mask should be breathable so that you filter through the mask. So when we talk and sneeze, it should not go out by the side. So imagine if we make a mask from aluminum foil, just taking the extreme, a ridiculous experiment, nothing will go through. What will happen is we still have to breathe and sneeze. It's going to go by the side. So in that case, mask is a false sense of protection. So mask should be such that most of the air goes through the mask. That's how it would filter what you're trying to filter. So it has to be breathable. So, you know, I know there are all kinds of fabrics that are used to make t-shirts. People ask me, is it knit? Is it woven? Some people have no idea about the type of fabric they're using. I would say, you know, don't worry about it. Just use two layers and you feel like, is it breathable? If it is, it's going to give you a good protection.
That's Tahir Saif, a mechanical engineering professor, at the University of Illinois, and he spoke with Christine Herman. A Northern Illinois company is looking into ways to extend the life of N95 masks, especially in the medical domain. Chase Cavanaugh tells us more.
N95 masks have long been used by doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers for their ability to protect the wearer against airborne diseases. The masks can filter out 95% of incoming particles, as long as they're properly fitted and maintain a tight seal with the face. But the coronavirus pandemic has demand far outstripping supply, particularly when considering CDC recommendations.
We needed that 3.5 to 5 billion. At the beginning of March, we only had 30 million in the national stockpile.
That's Brian Nelson, a mechanical design engineer at FN Smith, a precision machining firm in Oregon, Illinois. The company has been looking at ways to extend how long people can use the masks before being thrown away. To do this, they take into account how these masks keep out disease. Three layers of material impede airborne particles. The second layer has an electrical charge, which pulls particles to it like a magnet. Nelson says this charge degrades over time or when doctors decontaminate the mask with agents such as UV light, steam, or hydrogen peroxide.
A lot of those methods reduce the electrostatic charge. So we tried to look at, hey, how can we increase that electrostatic charge to increase the effectiveness and the ability of the device to protect the end user, the frontline workers.
FN Smith's solution is to recharge that layer in the mask.
When we are able to charge it by slamming basically one side of the material with electrons, we can shift the electron structure in the material, which causes that electrostatic buildup and allows us to pull things out of the air more efficiently.
The company is designing a device that would do just that. Nelson showed off an intercomponent where the mask would be placed under a series of black rods pointing downward. At first glance, it looks like nails waiting to be lowered. But Nelson says there's more at work.
We would hook up a power supply to this, and then those will, a certain charge of the power supply, and that will emit the electrons to the mask surface, which will cause that build up an electrostatic charge.
Nelson says this component would go into the final design.
The end unit would be a little bit smaller than a microwave and used as a standard wall outlet to work.
A handheld instrument could then be used to measure the mask's new charge level. Nelson says the design draws upon previous research into electrostatic charge and materials, including from NASA. He says the results are promising.
In some of this, especially with polypropylene, they said it could be recharged up to 10 times. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to recharge it every time after decontamination. Typically, from studies such as Stanford did, there was a 3 to 4 times of decontamination, then you would start to see the drop in electrostatic charge.
FN Smith has a patent pending on its device, and has reached out for certification from FEMA and the Department of Health and Human Services. But Nelson says the company doesn't have the industrial capacity for mass production.
We're looking to reach out to industries that are underutilized in their manufacturing capability, such as aerospace or bar and restaurant equipment, because we see that there's a slowdown for them right now in manufacturing, and we're hoping that their ability to mass produce devices could supplement our technology.
The choice of partner would then shape the look and inner workings of the device.
For the most part, we're just waiting to have the final design of it based on the manufacturing capabilities of those manufacturers, what tooling they have, so that we can kind of work with them on it instead of having to create new tooling, which could create a lapse in time before the device is out on the market.
Though the final design and production is still forthcoming, Nelson says a device like this could help alleviate the shortage of N95 masks. It could restore masks that lost their charge in storage, as well as extend the life of those already in use. That could have ramifications for healthcare workers both during and after the pandemic. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
As COVID-19 positivity rates in Rockford continue to rise, school bus drivers there are dealing with their new normal. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco has that story.
Katina Barnett is president of the School Bus Drivers Union Local 1275 in Rockford.
How's it been going so far?
It's been quite busy, without a doubt, very busy. Things have transpired from COVID taking out an entire world to people being laid off from their job and the world coming to a standstill.
The Rockford Public School District has a hybrid learning model so far this year, meaning some students are doing in-person classes. She says being a school bus driver during a pandemic is stressful.
Like this morning, I had 6 students that came to the bus stop, didn't have their mask on, had to dig it out of their book bag. And then I had a couple of them that didn't have masks at all, even in their book bags.
Barnett says she's used to being the fun bus driver, but she also knows the new safety policies are necessary.
You know, it's an ongoing battle for them. I really feel bad that they have to do it.
In the past, Barnett would reward the kids on Fridays by letting them pick where they wanted to sit for the day. Not anymore.
We have contact tracing, so they have to stay in their assigned seat. They have to sit with their sibling. So now you have a 5th grader sitting with his kindergarten sister. You know, he's frustrated because he wants to be with his peers. And she's looking at him like, why do I even have to sit with you? I don't like you. You're my brother.
Barnett says not all the new protocols make sense to her.
This particular year, they want us to wait till all the schools have ran for that morning, then clean the seats and wipe them down. I don't know if I agree or disagree with that one, because you're taking on 15, 20 kids per route, and then you're doing 3 schools. So now you put 60 kids without cleaning seats in between. I don't know if I agree or disagree. I guess that's not my decision.
But there's one policy that Barnett says really frustrates her.
One of the things that the district has incorporated that if little Susie's not assigned to your route, we can't take her. When years pass, if she wasn't assigned to your route and she went to your school, we take her in. And then we'll get her information. That way she's not left on a corner in a danger zone.
But in order to comply with COVID tracing, bus drivers now have to leave the child on the corner and call in another bus. Barnett says she understands the need for safety, but can't help but feel heartbroken.
Well, I can't even imagine what in the mindset of the child is to know that he's being left on the corner to wait for another ride to come pick him up because he can't be properly traced. And it's very frustrating.
The district's transportation department has confirmed these safety guidelines, but says that a case of children being left to wait for a new ride has only happened a handful of times. The changes have also affected the paychecks of bus drivers. Barnett says she still remembers finding out the schools would close back in March. It was the Friday before spring break, and over the dispatch radio she heard,
"Hey, by the way, we're not coming back after spring break. We're getting ready to get shut down." What? Even as union president, I was like, what's going on?
See, these are drivers that have health insurance. They have benefits. They have a pension. So in March, when all of this broke out, our focus was keeping our members employed.
That's Sarah Dorner, a union rep for the School Bus Drivers Union and the vice president of Rockford United Labor. She says that eventually the school board approved paying bus drivers their base pay through the end of the school year. But that was just the beginning.
So school support workers who are employed by a school system in Illinois do not typically qualify for unemployment during the summer.
And that's when it occurred to Barnett.
What do we do? And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we said, let's see if we can get unemployment for the first time ever. Everybody else is doing under COVID. Why not?
Dorner says that's when she and the union began calling every lawmaker they could, because suddenly some 750 school support staff were about to be without work and without access to unemployment. They finally heard back at the end of May that yes, school support staff could file for unemployment for at least the summer of 2020. But the way things are going in Winnebago County, Barnett is worried about her coworkers. What with the rising number of COVID-19 cases, which may threaten in-person learning.
And so, Katina, like, let's say they close down again, right? Maybe they don't make it past November. Do the bus drivers still have a way to get paid? You know, can they pay their bills?
I will never stop fighting for them. Never.
I will always fight for them to continue to get paid, because without these guys, this system doesn't work.
For now, her plan is to continue waking up each morning and getting behind the wheel to make sure she gets the students she cares about from point A to point B as safely as possible. I'm Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco.
We're glad you're tuned into Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you've missed any of our shows so far, or past episodes, you can find all of them at statewideshow.com. A proposed change to the Illinois Constitution is proving to be a very divisive election issue this year. Jerry Nowicki is Bureau Chief of Capital News Illinois, based in Springfield, and he spoke with Jenna Dooley about the ballot question and the legal opposition.
Let's start with the proposed amendment itself. Voters are seeing political ads and yard signs on both sides of the graduated tax proposal. You may also hear it called the fair tax by supporters or the progressive tax by opponents. Before we get into the fight over its future, Jerry, can you lay out how it would change the Illinois Constitution?
The Constitution right now requires that the income tax or any taxes on income be levied at a flat rate, meaning your first dollar is taxed at the same rate as your 1 millionth dollar. And currently that rate is 4.95%. So what this would do would allow lawmakers to apply a different rate depending on the level of income. Another law that was passed by lawmakers that is scheduled to take effect only if this passes would set those income tax rates. And it would be basically different rates on different levels of income. And the way it is set up is if you make $250,000 or less, you'd see basically the same or a lower income tax rate. Where if you make more than that amount, you'll see higher rates.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is very much behind this push. Why is he wanting this to get approval from voters?
It would bring in $3.4 billion in added state revenue. Illinois has basically been operating at a structural deficit. The governor says, you know, it'll help with creditors. And Moody's, all those types of organizations, we've gotten pretty close to junk status as a state, meaning the bonds are not investment grade and there'd be higher rates.
Voters received a pamphlet in the mail providing information on the proposed amendment change that they'll see on the ballot. A think tank once tied to former Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner, a Republican, is behind a lawsuit calling the ballot question and that pamphlet misleading. What are the claims in the lawsuit?
The wording they're having an issue with is it allows lawmakers to tax higher levels of income at higher rates and lower levels of income at lower rates. When they say higher isn't necessarily true, it's different levels, allowing the taxation of different levels at different levels of income. It doesn't necessarily mean that higher has to be higher, although, of course, that's the politically easiest and most likely path to be taken. It's not necessarily true in the law.
We're now less than a month before the election. What is the next step for this lawsuit?
What the Illinois Policy Institute would like is a corrective mailer to say, you know, different levels of income. They also want it to be known that the General Assembly would still have authority over tax rates in the future. And they filed an emergency motion, hoping to get the judge to do that as soon as possible. I reached out to the Attorney General's office as to what their response would be, and I'm still awaiting to hear on that.
But there's a lot of opposition and a lot of money going into the effort to convince voters that it's not the right step. Where's that money coming from?
The state's wealthiest person is basically the one bankrolling the anti-tax effort, whereas the governor is basically the one bankrolling the pro-tax effort. So Ken Griffin is the person, and he has billions of income, even dwarfing Pritzker's income, and he's given about $50 million, a little bit less than that, to the anti-tax cause.
That's Jerry Nowicki. He's bureau chief with Capital News Illinois, a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service covering state governments. Still to come on Statewide, a bug that's become more of a nuisance in Illinois and the Midwest. That story's ahead. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Stick around, we'll be hearing about an artist making the best of a bad situation after a devastating storm. But next, agriculture policy is not getting much attention in the run-up to the presidential election, but farmers are looking closely at what they might be able to expect from four more years of Donald Trump versus a Joe Biden administration. For Harvest Public Media, Jonathan All reports there aren't a lot of solid answers, and differences may not matter anyway.
Jim Mulhern says he's often asked what the next 4 years will be like depending on who wins the presidential election. The president of the National Milk Producers Federation says that really depends on how the candidates will treat trade. Mulhern says President Trump has created a mixed bag for farmers through a series of tariffs that have led to retaliation and a trade war with China and other countries.
Look, the president's been very clear. He sees the approach he's taking, this hardline approach, as one that in his mind works and I think is likely to probably continue. We have no reason to expect anything different.
Mulhern says those trade policies have hurt many farmers, but they tend to support the overall goal of holding other countries accountable and looking for better deals. In terms of Joe Biden, Mulhern says it's less clear.
None of us can give a real strong view of what a trade policy would look like in a Biden administration, other than likely to be attempts to do trade agreements like has been done in the past.
Specifically during the Obama administration, when Biden was vice president and Tom Vilsack was the Secretary of Agriculture. Biden has presented his plan for rural America, which includes general language about trade policies that work for farmers and promoting biofuels. That's exactly what Pam Johnson wants to hear. She and her family grow corn and soybeans on 1,000 acres in northern Iowa. She says she can't make it without a U.S. commitment to ethanol and other biofuels.
My farm's success and ability to survive depends on support of that market, that domestic market.
Johnson says tariffs that end up reducing her access to foreign markets also hurt. President Trump has been hard on ethanol until September, when he announced a policy approving use of existing filling station pumps to distribute higher ethanol gasoline. Johnson says it's too little, too late, and she's voting for Biden. But Scott Long says even though President Trump doesn't know a lot about agriculture, he has surrounded himself with people who do. Long, who raises cattle on 1,000 acres in southern Missouri and owns a 10-employee meat processing operation, says he likes Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue's commitment to reducing regulation.
As long as people have the right to farm and the right to run cattle or hogs, sheep, whatever they want to do, we need people in there that are going to respect that. And I think Sonny Perdue has that type of attitude toward it.
Long says Trump's hard line on trade will be worth it in the long run to all Americans, including farmers, and he supports the administration's policies. But the farm vote may not mean much this election. David Kimball is a political science professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He says rural voters overwhelmingly supported Donald Trump in 2016 and will again, regardless of how they feel about his agriculture policy.
A lot of rural voters are not farmers necessarily either, so the people working in the ag industry is a fairly small portion of the American electorate, which is, I think, another reason why, you know, agriculture policy may not be top of mind for many voters.
Kimball says the only way ag might be the difference is if the election comes down to one or two swing states with large rural areas. But with issues like coronavirus, the economy, and Supreme Court nominations looming large, agriculture issues won't get much attention between now and November 3rd. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
With fall upon us, you might notice some unwelcome guests trying to get inside your home. Certain insects are looking for a place to overwinter. I spoke last year with the U of I Extension educator Ken Johnson about the bugs we're seeing and what can be done about them, and we thought now might be a good time to revisit that conversation. One of those insects I've seen in recent years a lot more of is, it's a stink bug. Explain what we're talking about, the one that people are witnessing.
So the one we're seeing more and more here in Illinois is going to be the brown marmorated stink bug that was originally introduced into Pennsylvania in the 1990s. It's kind of spread across the United States. Right now, it's primarily a nuisance pest getting into people's houses and stuff, but this one is also a pest on crops, fruits and vegetables, stuff like that. And I think we're starting to now see in Illinois those populations getting high enough where we're getting some damage to some of our crops and stuff.
I think you answered my question. They haven't been in Illinois that long, so that's why I've not been seeing these for a lot of years. We've seen them, over maybe the last 5 to 7 years or so?
Yeah, somewhere around there. And then, as time goes by, those populations are just getting higher and they're becoming more and more prevalent in a lot of places around the state.
I would say prevalent, that's a good word for it, because it seems as though for something that hasn't been around in Illinois all that long, they are, I see them and I've heard from people in different parts of the state who are seeing quite a few of them.
Yep, so just like our, the Asian lady beetles, we get a lot, our box elder bugs, they're all trying to find somewhere to overwinter. A lot of times, when you see them on your house, they're going to be on that south or west-facing side that's nice and warm. They'll start congregating on those areas and then trying to find a way to get indoors so they have somewhere to spend the winter. Yeah, and unfortunately, that's kind of easier said than done trying to prevent them. Trying to make sure you don't have any cracks and crevices, kind of sealing, making sure your house is well sealed up, you don't have holes and screens, making sure your door sweeps aren't broken, making sure they can't get in through there. But they can get into pretty small places, unfortunately, and get into your house that way.
Now, we have seen stink bugs in the past, different varieties of these, I guess, that will put out an odor, thus the name. Do these do the same thing?
Yep. So we've got some native stink bug species. They look kind of similar. But, these brown marmorated stink bugs will also smell. So if you handle them, pick them up, you'll definitely know you're dealing with a stink bug when you do that.
But they can survive in a house maybe for a whole winter? That's possible?
Yep. So, they're coming inside. They will spend the winter in your house, inside the walls, in your attic maybe. And then come spring, when it starts warming up again, they will start making their way back outside.
So the other types of insects we're seeing, I think you touched on a couple of those, the lady beetles, and also we're seeing box elder bugs. Those have been around quite a while as far as this time of the year, them trying to get inside.
Yeah, so box elder bugs are one of our native species, so they've kind of always been around trying to get inside. The multicolored Asian lady beetles, the ladybugs are trying to get into your house. Those are another introduced species. They've been around a little bit longer than brown marmorated stink bug, but they're also trying to get indoors to find somewhere to spend the winter.
Well, you touched on a moment ago that exclusion is really the best approach here to try to keep these out of your home. But that goes beyond just doorways or windows, things of that nature. They can get in, I'm assuming, in other ways as well?
Yep, so if you have any kind of pipes coming into your house, making sure those are caulked so you don't have any gaps in there. Dryer vents, stuff like that, they can potentially get in through that. Siding, they can get up underneath that, so making sure your siding is kind of in good working order, soffits and eaves, all those different types of things. If there's a crack or way into your house, they'll more than likely they'll find it and make their way in.
So going back to the brown marmorated stink bug, which you mentioned is on the rise in Illinois, it's only been really showing up here, within the last decade. Is there any approach that people are taking to try to reduce the invasion of these bugs?
So in like your commercial production, your fields and stuff, I mean, people are spraying for them, they're monitoring for them, and stuff like that. But it's one of those things, once they get established, we're not going to be able to eliminate them. It's just going to be managing the populations of them.
And how big of a issue is that among, agriculture officials taking a look at this? Is this, is this on par with some of the others that we've seen, other invasive species?
It potentially could be in some of our fruit crops, or tree fruits or small fruits, stuff like that. A lot of that feeding damage is going to make those fruits unmarketable. They're going to have pitting and stuff on there. So it has the potential to be a pretty big problem for some of our different crops.
You wouldn't advise people to spray or anything like that?
So yeah, a lot of times when you're spraying, the sprays aren't necessarily all that effective because these insects are rather mobile. You could do perimeter sprays, spraying the outside of your house, but those sprays don't necessarily last all that long potentially. And as they move around, you know, they may be getting to areas where you didn't spray. So they're not necessarily all that effective. And then when it comes to getting indoors, typically we don't recommend spraying for them indoors. If people do have a lot of them indoors and you've kind of found a big population, you can vacuum them up and dispose of them that way. But in the case like the stink bugs, the multicolored Asian lady beetle, they have some defensive compounds that don't smell all that good. So a lot of times I'll tell people, try to use a kind of a cheap vacuum just for sucking up these insects. You don't necessarily want to use the vacuum you're using, you know, to vacuum your carpets and stuff, because that smell could get in there. And every time you vacuum, you're going to be releasing that.
That's U of I Extension educator Ken Johnson. And as for that relatively new invasive species, the brown marmorated stink bug, we have a photo of one at our website at statewideshow.com. The 100-mile-per-hour winds that swept across Iowa and northern Illinois in August produced more than power outages, downed trees, and other property damage. The fast-moving derecho gave wood artist Steve Sinner of Bettendorf, Iowa, an opportunity. Herb Trix tells us more.
The 78-year-old is an internationally acclaimed woodturner, and one of his latest projects is turning a chunk of a large tree trunk downed in Bettendorf into a beautifully polished vessel. Sinner says the hard maple trunk that he found along the road is ideal for his use because pieces he needs have to be as close to the center of the tree as possible.
In the entire time that I've been working wood, I've purchased a tree one time in the entire time. That was a hard maple, and that came from a woods out near Donahue and Dixon. There's actually a wooded area out there that's primarily hard maple, very unusual. It was a trunk that was probably more than 20 feet long straight, you know, so it was a lot of really, really good centered wood to use.
He's so well known for woodturning that most of the time, friends or acquaintances will call him and offer a tree they had to take down. Woodturning is the process of fastening wood to a lathe that rotates around a centralized axis, allowing artists to use a series of chisels, gouges, and other tools to carve away portions of the raw wood to create symmetrical forms.
These days, I have more access to wood as a general rule than I have time to work on it. So we did pick up from in McClellan Heights, we did get some maple over there also that was piled along the curb. But I did not I didn't intentionally go driving around and looking for it. I just happened to see these as I went by them.
And of the calls he gets from people, Sinner says he goes to look at about 10% of the trees, and just 10% of those are usable.
If you had a very large hard maple tree that would say when you cut it all up, if you didn't chip it, it would probably fill two or three dump trucks. Out of that entire tree, the wood that I would want would probably easily fit into my SUV.
The four tree species he's really interested in are walnut, sugar maple, hickory, and cherry. Sinner has produced many detailed pieces for years that are auctioned in fundraisers for the Figge Art Museum in Davenport and the public TV station WQPT, often netting thousands of dollars each. He's active in the Quad Cities chapter of the American Association of Woodturners, which is always on the lookout for downed trees. He says he didn't get many calls after the recent storm.
I think the storm, it was kind of a traumatic experience for a lot of folks, and it wasn't a matter of, oh, I'm looking for an opportunity to make something good out of this. Plus, they were left without, you know, most of us were left without power or internet, no way to charge our phones, and so on and so forth. So it just wasn't the normal sort of a situation where you lose a tree.
As for his own property, where he's operated a work studio since 2001, Sinner didn't see much tree damage. He regained electricity after 4.5 days, and was able to use a generator in the interim.
I lost the top of a sweet gum tree in the backyard, but it's not a huge loss because the tree was already in the process of dying. It's been losing limbs for 2-3 years. I'll probably have it cut down this fall anyway.
In addition to his art, which takes months for each piece, Sinner operates Advanced Lathe Tools, which makes and sells tools that he developed over the years to create his deep hollow vessels. For Jonathan Turner, I'm Herb Trix.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find links to the stories you hear at our website, statewideshow.com. All of our episodes are there, and you can also drop us a line. Let us know what you think. Also, you can see a schedule of where and when Statewide airs around Illinois. Until next time, I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.